slide presentation first. I think you'll find it interesting. Some of the material has been published, some of it is not. The first picture is through the courtesy of my friend from Library of Congress. The rest of the pictures, most of them are also in copy negatives at the Library of Congress, but this is a set of my own of copy negatives. And in one or two cases, it was important that I had done it, because in one case in particular, there's a date on it. And so you can date it exactly. Okay, let's start with the first thing on our presentation. Very good one. All right. This particular picture, if you'll notice, is a building, unmarked. It's in the Berliner collection at the Library of Congress. Where in the name of Holy Ned is the building? What is it? I thought it must be something connected with the early gramophone. Is it the Baltimore location, or is it elsewhere? Well, luckily, in the course of my research, I had copied the little bit of material that still existed from Joseph Sanders, who was getting questions from B.L. Aldridge and Roland Gillette when they were doing their respective histories. And Aldridge supplied Sanders with material about the exhibit that RCA had at Cherry Hill at one time. And there's a picture of 10th and Lombard Street in Philadelphia in 1925, when it was occupied by a printing plant. When you look at the printing plant, you find that it looks like the same building, except that there's been an extension at the rear here, and an added story has been added to it. But there is still the same little colonial building next to it. So obviously, this is 10th and Lombard, as far as I know, the only picture taken of the outside of the Berliner Gramophone Company. Let's go on. Here we go. This one is also mismarked on the original. It's marked about 1895. The only problem with it is that the young man who's back here, this particular young man is Joseph Sanders. And this is at the etching vats of the Berliner Gramophone Company laboratory in the powerhouse of the Capital Transportation Company in Washington. It couldn't be 95 because he was serving an apprenticeship in Germany in 1895. It's got to be 1897. Here's another one taken in the same one, and guess who this young man is? For those of you that are familiar with the early gramophone company records, that is W. Sinclair Darby, standing behind this lathe. There's another picture similar to that that was run by Ernie Bailey in the Talking Machine Review. Doesn't have Darby in it, but it has something very interesting standing on the lathe there. These were what they called rubber pressings, as far as I can tell. It was the practice of the company. They didn't do it always because Seaman didn't like it, because the grooves spread in doing it. But it was the practice of the company, if they had to make a duplicate of a matrix, and it was so important they couldn't do otherwise, they pressed it into these hard rubber blanks that were about that thick, and then grew another matrix into the hard rubber blank. So that was in the other one. Now let's go on. Unfortunately for the Berliner people, the powerhouse burned down in the end of September, and these are the ruins of the powerhouse the day after the fire. It really was an effective fire. It really did a job on it. As we've mentioned previously, the powerhouse had other people who suffered from the fire. The other one was Charles Sumner Tainter, who had his laboratory there also. And some of Tainter's experimental notebooks went down in the fire, along with a heck of a lot of stuff that Berliner had. Okay, the next one. After the fire, they set up a new matrix-making plant a couple of streets away. Here's a picture of it. Here's another one taken in the same plant. Rather primitive when you look at it and you think that this is the real origins of disc recording. Still another one. Now we're getting to it. Look at this sign here. Records, up to date, we have gramophone. This is taken inside of that building that we had the picture of before. Remember, as you will see with this paper, that basically what they did there is they had everyone else do the dirty work for them, and this was basically an assembling operation. But here's somebody enjoying the summer sun. It must be. Where would you get that intense a sun? And life is worth living, and of course, look at what we have over here. Wow. eat your heart out, Kurt. All right, here's still another one. You can see that the sun has really created a hot spot. And look down here. Here are the Johnson things unassembled with the horn brackets and everything ready to go. Wow, I wonder what serial numbers those are.
Do we know who that is in the picture?
No, we don't. Still another place in the factory. This must be the shipping room. And notice all of those beautiful little horns there. Pristine, brand new. And still another one taken in the same place, the recording room. This was published in the Library of Congress bulletin dated Washington or Philadelphia. Obviously it's not, it's Philadelphia. And this is 1898 also. Okay, still another one. Now this one's interesting. When the Berliner biography was published in 1926, they state this as 1895. But again, it can't be because you have a Joe Sanders in this. He even looks a little bit taller and more imposing than he did leaning against the etching vats there. And if you'll notice, on the top of that, of the photo, July 16th, 1898. And as you'll find out in my paper, this is immediately before Fred Gaisberg, over here at the left, and Joe Sanders here in the back with the glasses, got on the steamer to go to Europe to set up the recording studios of the gramophone company and the pressing plant in Hanover. A very important picture. We wouldn't really be able to accurately date it, but we've got a date right on the picture. And as I say, it's terrific. It ties in with Peter Adamson's article in that copy of the Hill and Dale News that they've been displaying in the awards table there. All right, still another one. This is an important picture because it's Germany. So what's that got to do with America? You can see how the operation has gotten a little bit more substantial and a little bit more sophisticated in this. These are the German etching baths, along with the rheostats and controls for the electricity. Still another German picture. This is the mixing room, where they're mixing the shellac, and you notice there's a lot of scrap shellac here, getting ready to go into the mixtures. Even at that time, you were having a problem with the companies putting too much scrap shellac in the thing. Still another one, the power plant of the German company. Some of these, as I say, have been printed, some of them have not. The set of negatives is obviously, not negatives, the set of prints is obviously much later. So many of them look as if they had been taken from glass plates, and the glass has been damaged, as you'll notice down on the bottom there. And in the previous one of the Washington operation, you can see some cracks in the glass. This one you've probably seen reproduced. It's an important picture because it's the only picture that I know of that shows how with the early pressing methods. Here they are. And this is interesting to me in another way. If you look at so many American pictures in the Edison pictures anyway, all of the men are all neatly dressed with their derby hats on and their rubber bands around their shirt sleeves. These men actually look as if they're working for a living. The shipping room. Wow, and testing, if you'll notice. Here are the record racks, and there they are, testing them on one of the early gramophones. And this is one of the pictures that I love. This is a European picture showing the original etching apparatus, Fred Gaisberg playing Napoleon, and over behind him is Sinclair Darby, and it looks as if he's got an extension to his mustache because the etching spout from the acid there cuts across his face and gives him that added little bit to it. Now that's the end of this presentation. If somebody wants to turn off the slide projector before we burn it up, and I am unhappy with the next person. Let me get to the lights here, because I have an apology to make. The apology is that this paper was being put together and I was having a progressive case of cataract, and it was getting worse and worse over the fall, and I finally had the operation in January. The trouble is that they put stitches in the eye and they didn't remove the stitches until the end of March. And when you're writing a paper, that can be a little bit difficult when you can't focus your eye and you've got a cataract that hasn't ripened in the other. So it's not as smooth as I would like it, but I think you'll find it interesting. If you remember, those of you that were at Washington, we had mentioned the original contract that had been written with Seaman and the Berliner people, and the fact that the contract in many ways was flawed and really set up the situation for a great many problems. Also, while I'm at it, I want to say a few very quick words. I was listening to the presentations yesterday and today, and you notice that those presentations were devoted to sonic restoration. And it struck me that much of what I am doing in my own research, hopefully, and in this paper, is historical restoration. Going back to the original documents, which nobody really seems to bother about in these things, except somebody like Tim Brooks or a few of the others who were doing important work, and without being influenced by any of the shibboleths and any of the state it once, and then three times later it becomes gospel, which is unfortunately endemic in this type of research, to try and come up with new conclusions. Or if there are no new conclusions, come up with the same conclusions. In doing it, by the way, I've had to go to a zillion different sites and sources. So much has come from court cases, other things such as that, the Edison site, because they had their little spies elsewhere, and also from the kindness, eventually, of EMI, which supplied me with a batch of Berliner and Seaman documents that had been written to Owen. So along with this, we come to the situation, as we mentioned in Washington, that the National Gramophone Company was never formally recognized by the Berliner Gramophone Company. And so as a result, the type of relationship they had at that particular time was for Frank Seaman to be really acting as an agent who then passed the material on to National Gramophone. Now, the trouble with this is that much as the Berliner people would try and do something about it, anything that that National Gramophone wanted to do on his own, technically, Seaman had no control of. So the thing first came to a little bit of a head in December 19th, 1897, after the Berliner people had finally said, that's it, we don't recognize them, and Seaman had had to reassign his contract and his agreement with National Gramophone back to National Gramophone because he really couldn't produce. And so you had in the New York Sun for Sunday, December 19th, 1897, the following ad: the Vocophone, The improved gramophone is the most of a Christmas present to be found in two hemispheres, from $5 to $25, etc. According to Thomas Parvin, the Berliner Gramophone Company demanded of Siemens an explanation of this advertisement, but no satisfactory explanation was ever given. But the ad was for the National Gramophone Company, not for Frank Siemens. Soon after that, another couple of red herrings started to come into the ointment. Later, the Oliver Ladau, who was the head of who was Siemens' secretary and also the head of a later company, the Universal Talking Machine Company, testified. On the ninth day of December 1897, we executed a certain contract between the National Gramophone Company and Thomas C. Mosley, the party of the second part, dated on that day, by which the party of the first part was to sell to the party of the second part 1 million gramophone records. Deponent further advers that the National Gramophone Company was to purchase such records from the plaintiff, who was Frank Siemens, who in turn would purchase them from the defendant. That's National Gramophone. The Berliner Gramophone Company contract was made with the understanding that the said 1 million records were so contracted for the specific agreement that the said records were to be used on a talking machine of a type different from the gramophone, and which talking machine, together with the records aforesaid, would be marketed by the second party, said party of the second part. He also mentions in the testimony that there's another individual who is buying records from them to sell for use on competing machines. I don't know what competing machine it is, but eat your heart out, machine collectors. During this latter half of 1897, the Siemens Group was constantly pleading for three machines to be added to their sales offerings. The first was an inexpensive model which would allow them to compete against the new Eagle Graphophone and later Edison's Gem, both designed to be the low end of each company's model lines. The second included a machine which could be used in the scheme goods trade. By the way, does everyone here know what the scheme goods trade is? Is there anyone who doesn't?
I don't.
Okay. Scheme goods were premiums. So if you subscribe, we'll say, to Leslie's Weekly, or you got so many subscriptions for Leslie's Weekly that give you a gramophone. So those are the scheme goods. Other companies did it also. We are still hoping, and a letter to Owen on August 20th, 1897, Siemens summarized the situation. We are still hoping for a nickel in the slot and small motor. The Berliner Gramophone Company have promised them when we will tell them exactly what we want, but they require so much red tape about it, it's hard to say when they'll get going. The Columbia Phonograph people have just put on the market a $10 graphophone, which they advertise will give as good results as their $25 machine. Seems suicidal to me for them to do this, but I presume they expect to make money out of the records, which they sell at 50 cents apiece. By now, Siemens was ready to make a move towards reducing the cost of the materials. He announced in his letter to Owen, "We have submitted by another party a motor which we can get made for $2, which we believe fully equals Johnson's motor. It is, in fact, quite similar, but I am advised does not infringe upon his. My idea is to use this cheaper machine for the scheme goods trade to sell at $10 net, using a stained white wood box with some other slight modifications from the style number 25. For those of you that are in the know, that proposed machine was one made by Levi H. Montrose. To continue, I think the $10 graphophone has hurt us with the scheme goods people. We can get this $10 machine ready for delivery in about 30 days. On October 18th, he was able to inform Owen that Montrose has submitted a very clever model of a $10 machine, and we are thinking of ordering 2,000 to help us out of our present dilemma. Johnson has delivered 6 samples of the toy machine to the Berliner Gramophone Company, and we expect them here tomorrow. They will cost, ready to ship, not to exceed $1.50. I'd like to get one of those now for $1.50. In a letter to the head of the Berliner Gramophone Company, Siemens says, "Dear sir, Mr. Levi H. Montrose has submitted to me a model for the proposed motor which can be used for our scheme goods trade and otherwise. The price is fixed at $2 each to include the motor complete, the insertion of the motors in the boxes all ready for operation, the nickel-plated arm, and the packing of such motor is factory. We to furnish the packing boxes and the package to contain all accompanying parts to make the complete and working machine. See, by doing it this way, but the tone arm going on and the sound box, then the Berlin, the patented stuff, goes on to the thing. Mr. Montrose is to agree to begin delivery of motors not less than 6 weeks from the date of order, and is to furnish them as much earlier as possible. The Berlin Gramophone Company replied to Seaman, "Dear sir, we are in receipt of your letter of the 25th instant, ordering 2,000 motors of the design furnished by Mr. Montrose. I have a long interview with him today, and it is impossible for me to give him the order or for him to accept it exactly in the form in which you have given it to us." Commenting on this, Johnson wrote to William Barry Owen, "There has been a large number of cheap talking machines sold this year. There has been no improvement in the gramophone since you left, and there is no chance to make any, as Mr. Seaman's sole object is to cheapen the manufacturing cost." Those of you that remember Washington, the contract he had with the Berliner people is that they always got 40% over their cost. So there was no incentive for the Berliner Gramophone Company to cut their cost, because it also cut their profit. If you could sell something for $10 to Seaman instead of $2, 40% on that is a lot more than 40% on $2. At the same time, the Johnson application for a patent on a spring motor, which had been filed on August 19, 1897, was running into trouble in Washington, and 6 of his 9 claims were rejected on December 21, 1897. 12 new claims were submitted on January 8, 1898. There was a further rejection of Claim 10 on references to other patents, including that of Edward Amett. After this claim was erased, the patent was allowed. Normally, there was up to a 6-month time between the allowance and the payment of final patent office fees, but Johnson and his backers were swift to submit the $20 filing fee on March 1, 1898. And so the patent was granted in a remarkably short time after a notification of 22 days. Johnson had already noted, "Mr. Montrose has not yet finished his sample yet. It has been sent to New York several times, but has not been accepted. I am still on top, unless the opposition greatly improves, and will be on top for some time to come." Meanwhile, Joseph W. Jones, most of you have heard of Joe Jones. He comes up in the history later. Was being backed not only by a person named Albert T. Armstrong, a Mr. Vincent, but partners in a new arrangement, C.G. Kahn of Elkhart, Indiana, and Emory Foster of Washington, D.C. Prototype machine was developed, the Wonder, which relied on a double-belled horn. Business was started on 14th Street in New York. But as Armstrong was forced to admit in later testimony, Jones found it difficult to produce satisfactory machines, and Armstrong estimated that not more than 50 or 60 sample Wonders were sent out. The same situation occurred with attempts to produce records. The existing Wonder catalog would seem to indicate that Jones was copying by pantograph both disc and cylinder titles. After suit was brought by the Berliner Group, the company disbanded. And listening to Kurt this morning, you know how rare the Wonder records are. They have located one for the list. William Barry Owen had made sufficient headway in England to require numbers of machines and records. Emil Berliner wrote to Seaman with a proposition. "I have a cable from Mr. Owen to this effect. He can place 10,000 machines and 600,000 records and is willing to come over to the United States to superintend manufacture of them here and is willing to pay you, the Berliner Gramophone Company, together, $1 royalty for each machine and 50 cents per dozen records so as to have your assent, so that he can So they can have machines made, original records taken, matrices made, and record manufactured, all with such assistance as I need render him, etc. At the same time, another element was added to the picture. Calvin G. Child later testified concerning the fact that shortly before Christmas 1897, in an interview in New York with the said Seaman and Liddell, he was told that the National Gramophone Company and the said Seaman wished to place themselves in such a position that they might be independent of the Berliner Gramophone Company in all branches of the business, should they desire at any time to do so. That the said Seaman asked the deponent if he could conduct some experiments in making matrices. That these experiments were begun immediately after Christmas in 1897, and, Jerry, listen, that Theo A. Wangerman, they've got the name backwards, of Flushing, Long Island, was engaged by the deponent to assist him in this work, and that the work of making the matrices was done by Rhinebeck and Sons Electrotypers of New York, that this work was continued until the middle of March, and all samples and experiments made were submitted to the same Seaman and said Liddell for criticism and approval. For those of you that aren't in the know, A. Theo Wangerman was Edison's original recorder working up in the music room in 1888 and 1889. And it's Wangerman that kept the log that appears in Alan Koenigsberg's book. In the fall of 1897, Seaman was able to persuade the Berliner Group to allow him recording studios in New York. Live demonstrations of recording were often given for invited audiences. By the way, one of our friends here is a military band collector. You don't know who that is, of course. And as Fred well knows, Seuss's band did one of those demonstrations. Similar demonstrations were also conducted in Brooklyn and in Boston. Meanwhile, on February the 3rd, 1898, incorporation papers were filed by Orlando J. Hackett and Edward A. Reeser of 10 Wall Street and William Moyes of 160 Broadway to organize the Universal Talking Machine Company to manufacture, buy, own, and sell coin actuating and other automatic devices, and also machines for reproducing musical and other sounds. And you have the usual other gobbledygook that comes with such a contract. Capitalization was to be a modest $20,000, and significantly, the location of the principal office was to be in Yonkers, which was also the residence of Frank Seaman, and also the seat of the National Gramophone Company. Oliver Liddell was now made president of the new company, but he did not give up his position as secretary and manager of the National Gramophone Company, I'm quoting, by the way, nor does his acceptance of this position change in any way his close relation to Frank Seaman. This is a testimony of Parvin. In the latter part of July 1898, Seaman and Liddell showed me, Thomas Parvin, a slot machine, telling me at that time that they had no interest in it further and that they had contacted with the man who had perfected it to sell him 1,000 gramophones to be used in connection with the slot attachment. Early in August, the Universal Talking Machine Company and the National Gramophone Company employed William Newcomb jointly to represent both companies in the sale of gramophones and slot machines. Liddell himself later testified concerning the origins and later and early history of Universal, that the deponent had been an officer and director of Universal since its organization, and the same was conceived and suggested and organized by the deponent. That the reason for its organization was that the plaintiff had failed to secure from the defendant, for the use of the National Gramophone Company and his other customers, a machine which could be used with a coin actuating device, employing a gramophone for the production of the sound. That said National Gramophone Company and Seaman had been very anxious to secure such a machine to increase the sales of gramophones, and the defendant has been endeavoring to produce the same. He says, however, it proved, however, impossible to market such machines, and only a few have been sold. On February 24th, 1898, the National Gramophone Company inserted in the New York Evening Post, the plot begins to thicken, an advertisement in which the gramophone was designated as the Xenophone, improved gramophone. On February 25, 1898, Thomas Parvin wrote a letter remonstrating against the use of the word Xenophone in the advertisement. There was no proper explanation of this advertisement, and National continued to advertise the gramophone as the Xenophone. Seaman made a personal promise to abstain from such advertisements, but he did not keep his promise and subsequently reserved the use of the word Xenophone in advertising, end of quote. Liddell gives a slightly different picture. The advertisement using the word vocophone and Xenophone were withdrawn by the National Gramophone Company at the request of the plaintiff, who stated in making the same that he represented the defendant who desired that such names be not employed. But as stated in the affidavit of Frank Seaman, the similarities between graphophone and gramophone greatly damaged the business of selling gramophones. Soon afterwards, on March 25, 1898, Seaman's hand must have been forced by the following letter received by the Berlin Gramophone Company in relation to the Montrose machine. In a situation where the purchase of the machines had to be funneled through the Berlin Company, and in which there was a significant financial support for Johnson provided by the members of the Berlin Gramophone Company, Montrose could not win. He was forced to relinquish the royalty that Johnson was to pay him for his interests in exchange of the right to make 2,000 machines for the scheme good market. Gentlemen, my attention has been called by my client, Mr. Eldridge R. Johnson, to a gramophone motor manufactured, as we are informed, by the Montrose Metal Shingle Company of Camden, New Jersey. We understand that this machine is being manufactured by the same Montrose company for your company in considerable numbers. I would say I have compared the construction of the Montrose motor with Letters Patent 601-198 issued to the same Eldridge R. Johnson, March 22, 1898, and I find that the construction clearly infringes the claims of the said Johnson patent. Notice what I said about them rushing the patent through. The patent was granted on March the 22nd, the letter's written on March the 25th. Very, very quick. As if to underscore the victory, Eldridge R. Johnson formally assigned a one-half interest in his patents to Thomas S. Parvin, the president of the Berlin Gramophone Company, on April the 14th, 1898. Gee, strange, isn't it? As an indication of the cooling relations between Seaman and the Berliner groups, a letter of April 13, 1898 is significant. With reference to the National Gramophone Company not selling machines to parties who may export same to Europe, may I ask if you intend to give the National Gramophone Company the same protection in South America? During the spring of 1898, George H. Burt, a manufacturer of composition goods such as billiard balls, poker chips, etc., applied to the Berlin Gramophone Company of Philadelphia for the opportunity to compete with others in the manufacture of the above described records. He satisfied the Berlin Gramophone Company of his ability to produce both quality and quantity of the gramophone records needed. Burt then noted that the suggestion that he could make the records for a much less price than others, but could guarantee the quality of his product. Parvin protested that a lower price would interfere with the commission which the company was receiving. Burt was told that if he expected business, he must harmonize. Burt then maintained prices. He then received matrices from the Berlin Company and pressed them. Shortly after he began to make these records, Mr. Emil Berliner appeared at his, the deponent's place of business in Melbourne, and he, Berliner, expressed himself pleased with the results as obtained from the aforesaid matrices. Negotiations began for Berliner to purchase the formula. Later, Burt went to Philadelphia, accompanied by Oliver Liddell, fatal mistake, for the purpose of increasing his orders. The orders then fell off and eventually ended. In a letter to Owen, Berliner mentioned testing two samples of Burt records 50 times, using a new needle after every three times. They showed not the slightest mark nor difference in tone against the portion of each record that had not been played. I am keeping in close touch on this with the view of securing the recipe for Europe, if possible. Many years later, Joseph Sanders recalled, I made a search and found in a notebook that it was Milburn, I believe, in New Jersey. Mr. Bird had been pressing some records for us and arranged to show me the manufacturing and processing of the material. This was in May 1898. By now, Frank Seaman must have decided to use his Universal Talking Machine Company for something other than the manufacture of modified gramophones for coin operation. He was being thwarted on the home front, and although he had been cooperating up to a point with Owen, was beginning to attempt to penetrate the European market on his own. In a letter of May 4th, Berlin noted, "I have not the slightest idea who started the gramophone company in Paris, but I believe they can be run out of the market in short order." And in a letter to Owen on May 31st, 1898, he stated that, "Owing to the unbusinesslike blunders made in New York, the business in the United States is not gaining ground, but that Mr. Seaman relies on the export business to keep up his orders to the Berliner company, and that explains the desperate efforts to get a hold of a slice of the European business." Even so, the next move must have sent shockwaves, as the whole situation seems to have come to a head in relation to Seaman attempting to become involved in France. This was vividly shown in a long letter to Trevor Williams in England. And I'm only giving you a few excerpts. In the printed court testimony, the letter takes over 3 pages. "We are sorry and more than surprised to read that you suspect our goodwill and intention toward you, and that we have knowingly supplied machines and records for exportation. We say surprised because we presume you refer to a shipment, the order for which was received while you and Mr. Owen were in this country. The matter was laid before Mr. Owen, and he distinctly and positively agreed that we should ship these goods, the profits from the sale of which he shared to be shared with him personally. With reference to the cablegram as to your dealings in France, it was dictated by the duly authorized representative of the National Gramophone Company, whose action is herein confirmed and for which we become completely and entirely responsible. We have told you over and over again that the claims of Mr. Berliner in foreign countries are practically worthless. We made this a point in our arguments as to the desirability of an amalgamation of interests. You state that our attitude is the more accentuated because the action proposed naturally endangers the agreement which we hold with the Berliner Company of Philadelphia. We have no agreement with the Berliner Company of Philadelphia and are neither known to them nor are they known to us officially. This company is independent of the agreement to which we presume you refer, nor are we dependent upon the product of that company." Aha. We told you distinctly at the very outset of our negotiations that this company was determined to reap the benefits of its prestige in foreign countries, and that there were two ways by which this could be done, the one by peaceable means and the other by force. We will finish your contract when you arrange for the payment of your goods thereunder on this side. No other arrangement will be satisfactory. After that order shall have been completed, if you desire to negotiate further, we shall be pleased to consider your favors. If, on the contrary, you think that you can get along without the cooperation and support and friendship of the National Gramophone Company, it is your right to so think and to so act. Certain it is that if you choose to take such a course, you do it with your eyes open after what we have said to you and written herein." This is Ladau to Williams, who's head of the gramophone company in England, and to which Seaman writes, by the way, a little PS on, and says, "I entirely agree with it." In 1953, Joseph Sanders recalled, "Our getting into the picture over there was due to the National Gramophone Company cutting them off from supplies. This caused Gaisberg and myself, Sanders, to go over on cable notice. Gaisberg started the recording laboratory, and I went to Germany and started the matrix plant and record pressing plant in Hanover. On June 9, 1898, Berliner wrote Owen, 'I'm waiting now for your further requests about going ahead in Europe and have made all preparations to help you.' On July 1, 1898, he wrote further, 'My intention is to send Sanders to Hanover as soon as they wire that installation, instruments, etc., are ready, and when he goes, I must stay here to look after matrix making. H.H. Eldred testified in 1900 that during the summer of 1898, he was employed by Frank Seaman. His employment by the said Seaman was especially for the purpose of exporting the gramophone and introducing the same into Europe. That prior to sailing to Europe on August the 11th, he was instructed to order 100 celluloid labels on which the following words appeared, the label being the size below indicated, about this big. The Xenophone, improved gramophone, patented in US and foreign countries. Eldred was instructed to scratch off the decalcomanias on any machines that were sent to him, and to apply, tack that label on in the place of the decalcomania. Liddell states, by the way, thereafter, in order to meet the demands of the foreign trade wholly without the United States, said Universal Talking Machine Company manufactured and shipped abroad for use exclusively abroad certain spring motors capable of being used in sound reproducing machines through the addition of the necessary parts, and caused them to be so sent abroad where they were sold to the customers of said company. That such manufacture and sale brought the National Gramophone Corporation and to the plaintiff orders for a large number of records for use in such foreign countries with and upon such machines. It was greatly to the advantage of the Berliner Gramophone Company and the National Gramophone Company. That in order to avoid confusion and conflict and conserve the rights of all people, a name different from the gramophone was adopted for said machines, and of course that was the Xenophone. We have seen from the affidavit of Henry K. Smith that the Berliner Company had paid for the experiments of Eldred Johnson, and I suspect most of his plant expansion. Some proof of this may be found in the previously mentioned Leber of Assignments of the Patent Office, in which Johnson assigned his undivided half interest. This consisted of what became later patent 655-556 and 624-625. Working under such arrangements, Johnson now began a series of experiments aimed at improving the quality of recording. According to Smith, the Berliner Company began to pay out monthly large sums of money on the account of experimental work so conducted by Johnson, and in that manner expended in the neighborhood of $5,000 together with about $3,000 in addition for machinery purchased for use in such work. Said Johnson constantly reported progress. And when a year ago, in late 1898, early 1899, practical results began to be accomplished, Johnson sold the rights in Europe and the company recovered $15,000 upon such sale. Johnson received a commission of $5,000, and the Berliner people made a net profit of about $2,700, and they still had the rights in the States. As we have mentioned previously, the group backing Joseph W. Jones, Jerry, you'll be happy, I've only got two pages left, and his Wonder Phonograph had been increasingly frustrated by the lack of any real progress. Jones found it as difficult as Johnson and Montrose to produce a dependable machine. This, along with a small stream of adequate records, caused the partners to close up their standard talking machine company after a suit had been brought by the United States Gramophone Company and the Berliner Gramophone Company. Albert T. Armstrong, who was one of the promoters of that, had learned his lesson with Standard. Probably in October of 1898, negotiations were conducted between Joseph W. Jones and the American Gramophone Company, which resulted in the granting by Jones of a license to use his United States patents, applications, and inventions. Although the license was signed by Edward Easton of American Gramophone and Joseph W. Jones with the consent of Joseph A. Vincent, who had been Jones's original backer, the real moving force behind the license was revealed by a letter from Easton to Armstrong. Yours of October 28th was duly received. I have telephoned you several times in an attempt to get a reply, but did not reach you. It is manifestly proper to make provisions for Mr. Jones. The only question is how, and that may not concern him very much if the provision is satisfactory. If we use none of his machine patents, and we do use his records, the fact should make proper treatment. Jones, then provided a description of his secret process to the American Graphophone Company on December 2nd, 1898. As a result of all of this, American Graphophone mounted an attack. Suits were instituted in United States Circuit Courts in New York against the National Gramophone Company and Frank Seaman, and in Philadelphia against the Berliner Gramophone Company. I'd often wondered why they only sued the one company, and then when I started my research, I found out why. They didn't. They sued both. The alleged claim in the Bell and Tainter patents was the use of the universal joint carrying the Berliner tone arm. This concept had already been used against Edward Emmett, Ecophone, and Metaphone, and possibly the success against Emmett suggested that it could be used against the Berliner group. Coincidentally, the Berliner people may have suggested to American Graphophone to do this, because they had threatened Emmett with infringement because of the same universal joint. It never went to court, by the way. They just threatened him and they dropped it. Both Philadelphia and the Southern District of New York suits were to be tried concurrently, and evidence used in one might be used in the other. In a relatively short time, the New York suit, which had been instituted on October 22nd, resulted in an injunction on December 15th. Preliminary injunction was granted, but stayed pending an appeal. An appeal, the injunction was dissolved, and the case returned to the lower court for a full hearing on the merits. And that is the end of this exciting installment of our ARSC serial. The next one, with Flash Gordon hanging over the pits, hopefully will be at the next exciting session of ARSC. Thank you. How do you like that? Right on the button. Right on the button.